expunge their record for traveling purposes. What is the current situation with the United States border? At one time, it didn't matter to them whether you had a pardon or not. If you had a record and they had it on their computer, which they did, you didn't get over. What is it now?
That is still the case with the United States, largely because the U.S. has access to our police database, CPIC. So the U.S. does not recognize any kind of pardon, record suspension, whatever you might call it. Some people who do business, truckers, for example, can apply for a waiver, which allows them to go back and forth across the border. That costs a fair bit of money. Takes about a year to get. But no, they don't recognize the pardons. Travel to other countries is more open, partly because the other countries don't have the same access to our police records. So they have no way of knowing if the person coming in is convicted of something, not convicted, on parole, pardon, what have you. So in terms of getting to other countries, sometimes having that pardon or record suspension, if they have to fill out a visa form, for example, can be quite helpful. But the U.S., you're not going anywhere. Even now with the pot pardons, I wouldn't count on getting across to the U.S.
Next question over here. We ask you to use the mics, not because of audibility, but simply because we are also recording the event. And so you'll be able to hear all this. We'll have it up on the site, church site, in a couple of weeks. So that's why we ask you to use the mics.
Dan.
I asked my friend Maureen how honest I should be. And she said, use your own discretion. Well, I was convicted of both first and second degree murder at 18 years old. I was a drug addicted, gang related, miserable person. I did 33 and a half years. I've been out less than 30 days.
Wow.
It took a long time for that rehabilitative process to kick in. And you're right about hope. We have to keep that hope. It began once I sobered up. It was a very hard thing to do because there are very few programs really that will help you to beat an addiction inside.
Yeah.
My question to you, I guess, is once I made that conversion and began to rehabilitate myself, to look for that thing within me that would make me able to sit here today, it still took almost 10 years to get to a parole board because corrections never believes a success story. How can we change that perspective?
Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you very much for your candor and for the journey that you're on. Congratulations. Yeah, and this is another reality inside. It's tough. There aren't that many programs to begin with, and I just did a talk with David Cole last week about I put in an information request to CSC to find out about programs in Ontario region, which is stuff they should have on the website, but it took them 4 months, long past the legislative deadline. There are so few programs, and there are such long wait lists to get into the programs, and if you're serving life, you are not at the front of the line for those programs, as you know. It's the people with short sentences, parole dates coming up, who are going to get into those programs. One of the great things about the young woman at the Healing Lodge is if you're motivated earlier in your sentence to do something like that, then do it then, because otherwise the longer you sit and self-justify, the harder it can be. How do we improve things inside? Well, as you may know, out of Correctional Services' total budget, programs are only 3-5% of the total budget. When you send someone to penitentiary, you are buying bricks and mortar and staff. That's what you're paying for. So the only way really around this is somehow to reduce the number of people going to penitentiary, get a bigger budget going for programs, and the low-risk people, get them out a little sooner into the community. I won't go on at length. We did a study recently, and CSC didn't like it because it didn't fit their narrative. About half the inmate population is actually low-risk. And they could be out a lot sooner. So there are things that could be done. More emphasis on the community side. You hear this from everyone. especially anyone who's worked in community corrections, is so underfunded, under-resourced, because it's not just about getting out, as you know, it's about staying out, too, and having that support. I don't know if he's here today, but a colleague named Rick offers a program, a peer support program, for gang members to break out of the gang, and also helps prepare lifers for life on the street. Because it's been a while, eh? I mean, how about those ATMs? How about those cell phones? yeah, it's a big adjustment. And that's really the answer, is to get the system itself to shift. But gosh, that takes political backbone too. And I don't want to be, you know, Debbie Downer, but I'm not seeing that political backbone. You know, this consecutive life, consecutive parole ineligibility, I went back to see, did the Liberals support it when the bill was before the House? And they were really kind of fuzzy. They didn't tip their hand one way or another, but you know who supported it? The NDP. Loud and clear. NDP supported the 50-year, 75-year parole ineligibility. So there's not a lot of hope there. Okay. So I guess all I can say is, yes, try to find the people in the system who do believe in the community side and believe in people. Put the pressure on the government. More funding for programs and release. And I hope you've got like lots of support in the community. And I just, I'm so impressed. Yeah, exactly. And I bet this church would be huge support as well. Congrats.
Okay, sorry. My question was a follow-up to your answer. I was wondering to know how much rehab and education support is available. And you're, I'm hearing you say a very small amount, and does that vary across the country in terms of regions and levels of the courts, the federal courts and the lower levels of court? And secondly, for people coming out, I, you know, as an ordinary citizen, I don't have a sense that there's a lot of support programs. I mean, I know about John Howard, and I just heard you saying one particular peer support program, but like that would be a huge area that if any of us want to advocate, to know just how little is available for people. So instead of just warehousing them, that they can be developing themselves and recovering while they're doing time, and then how do they possibly manage when they come out? How do they find housing, you know, have a home, you know, a job and a friend?
Mm-hmm. When I put in the access to information request about programs, that was, you know, whatever, 4 or 5 months ahead of the conference. And I thought, well, yeah, you know, what the heck, I'll go to the source. I won't rely on my own memory and knowledge. They are supposed to reply within 30 days. And I thought, oh, boy, I know these guys. I was going to ask for the whole country and the programs in all the penitentiaries across the country, and I thought, no, Mary, that would be a big mistake. So I only asked for Ontario region, and as I say, it was like 3 days before the conference when I got the last piece of information about the programs in Ontario, and that information should be on their website. There is nothing secret about it, and you could write to the commissioner of CSC, Ann Kelly, and ask her to put this program information on the website so people would know. My sense is that it's about the same across the country. I don't have any sense that it's going to be that much better in other parts of the country, particularly programs for women. There are specialized programs for Indigenous people, for people with mental health, which is a huge issue, people with addictions. But again, there are wait lists. This Ontario told me there are wait lists for every single program. Job skills. You know what I'm going to say here. Job skills for women who are often single parents. When they come out, they've got mouths to feed. They've got to get a job. The job skills program for women in Quebec at CSC is making men's underwear for male inmates. All right? There is no underwear industry, people. What job are they being prepared for? The job skills training at Kitchener is making towels and sheets. All right? You've been to home ec class? 4 straight seams. There is no towel and sheet industry in Canada. That's the job training we're giving the women. Like, please. Part of it is, of course, no access to computers. How do you train anyone for a job these days if there isn't technological assistance to work on? Now, they do have a few trades programs, but in Ontario region, they have three programs that are Red Seal programs. If you work in the trades, you know what Red Seal it is. You get certified in Ontario, and you can work in any province. So electricians, for example, that's a Red Seal program. That's great for the inmate population because there's a lot of movement around. We only have three of those. And in terms of more programs, again, it's just a question of budget, because the bricks and mortar and the staff wages cost so much. What can you do for people coming out? You know, one simple thing, a lot of people come out, they don't have any photo ID. This sounds so simple, doesn't it? And Ontario had a couple of pilot projects to get people photo ID before they left the penitentiary. What can you do without photo ID? You can't open a bank account. You can't do anything. And these people are inside, their driver's license expires, they don't have a new health card, nothing. All of that could and should be done while they're inside, so at least they walk out with photo ID. If a group of people got together and said, we're going to, you know, go to X halfway house, or X prison, and we're going to set up a program to help them get their photo ID, that'd be huge. It's a very simple thing.
Okay, my name is Niels, and I'm a member of the Citizen Advisory Committee for Downtown Toronto.
Yep.
So I'm very aware of what this gentleman talked about, and also about the programs and the stigma people have when they come out of prison. Mm-hmm. But one thing is also the aging population coming out. They have no idea, no feeling for money. They have no ID. I have personally done more than 400 IDs for people coming out. Mm-hmm. That is mainly birth certificates, which can be done free, but takes 2 months. Yep. And then citizenship, which is a long term. So that will take about 10 months to get. In the meantime, they sit, when they're on parole, they sit, they cannot really do anything for 10 months because they cannot access a bank, they cannot do. But the thing I really want to talk about the older people, because a lot of inmates are now getting older and they come out 65 plus. Mm-hmm. And what do? They have to get a room in a basement. They don't know about the money. Mm-hmm. But next Saturday or next Sunday, over on Manor Road, two ministers, Bob Oliphant and the industrial minister, they're having a meeting, and I for seniors, and I'll bring that up. I'll bring up and say, here we have a case, and then. But I enjoy you, and I know about people coming out. It's overwhelming experience for them, and that's constant. So, thank you.
Thank you, and that's a really important point. No one's going to get paroled just because they're old, notwithstanding what Rosie DiMano wrote this week in her column. And the problem with people coming out is, first of all, seniors' residences, whether, you know, of whatever type, they're very reluctant to take people with a criminal record who are on parole. So that's obstacle one, that people just can't get into those facilities. And the other aspect is a lot of halfway houses are just not set up to accommodate geriatric residents. So, for example, there's a halfway house a couple of blocks from my place, but it's an old Victorian house of three stories, no elevator. It's, you know, stairs. Well, they're just not set up to provide care to people with health needs when they're 80 or what have you. So it is a real need. Housing is huge. And, you know, every time it's NIMBY, we don't want a halfway house in our backyard, like, please. Anyway, yeah, it's a big issue. So the more you can raise it in your community, what are we doing to help older inmates? Because it is the biggest growing population inside.
Thank you for staying interested in this topic. This is an easy subject and an easy population to not care about.
Yes.
My friend Ellen and I, we actively advocate and have for the last 10, 15 years now, Ellen's saying 20, years for a Toronto man who's incarcerated in Florida. He was charged with a crime and convicted back in 1987. He was 2 months past his 18th birthday. The trial lasted 7 hours. He was convicted on the eyewitness testimony of a man who was drunk at the time and pissing out the back window of a car. So he has now served over 30 years in prison in Florida. We are, the stats you gave today, we are not surprised at all. Like, Florida doesn't even compare to what we have here. Our question, our biggest challenge has been the politicos, the political side. You talked about the liberals, the conservatives. We've had some good help. Senator Pate is helping us. But our issue has been with Corrections Canada. Mm-hmm. Very lovely people, very nice people, the bureaucrats. But when it comes to actually helping, and when I hear you say people need to speak out and put the facts on the table, we were successful in getting a meeting with the Florida governor about a month ago. The Corrections Canada representative was invited to attend the meeting. He said, no, I won't attend, but I'll participate by phone. And then at the last minute, did not participate and said he sat by his desk and waited for somebody to call him. And that's why he didn't participate, which was soul-destroying after all the work we had done to arrange a meeting with the Florida governor. So my question is about Corrections Canada and how much is Corrections Canada actually helping Canadian people incarcerated?
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear your story, and I don't doubt it for a minute. One of my jobs was not doing the actual transfers, but the legislation and the whole transfer program. Your comments about CSC and where are the staff, they're nowhere. Unfortunately, it's very difficult to communicate with them or get them to do something that they don't wish to do. And that's been the case for quite a while. It's not any better today than it was 10 years ago. It's probably a little bit worse. I think the public service lost a lot of good people. First of all, a lot of people left when the policy of the last government was just too difficult to work under. Anyone of a certain age left, basically. And a lot of the people there don't have a lot of corporate history or real passion for the job, unfortunately. All I can say is to keep trying, to just keep at them, because that's the only thing that will ultimately get through. Like, of all the emails and phone calls and things that I make, you know, a lot of them never reply. They, you know, I don't hear anything. And you just have to keep at it. But, you know, for that transfer, there's got to be some push from Florida and there's got to be some pull from Canada. I would continue to work through, in fact, the politicians on that one, because they tend to be the most sympathetic, particularly if it's someone from their riding. But, no, we went through a real change with international transfers under the last government, you know. They were elected, as I always said. Nobody elected me. They were very clear that they were going to let Canadians sit in the foreign countries. They were not going to bring them back. And I'm told this government has improved its track record. You could, I don't know if you've contacted anyone in the Department of Public Safety, which is a separate body, which is where I worked, and you could try.
Well, we have. We've been fortunate in that the Minister of Public Safety did approve his transfer, so
okay.
It's been approved 3 or 4 times at this point. The Minister of Public Safety, though, when we contact them, takes the stance that we will not interfere with foreign governments in terms of what they'll do.
Yeah.
We approve it, and that is the end of what we will do.
Yeah.
So they won't even make a call. They won't. It's like this wall we hit where they won't do anything beyond saying, sure, we'll approve the transfer.
But that
sadly doesn't go anywhere. So maybe a question is, do we just go right back to the ministry and just keep bugging them until they actually do something?
That's one option, yeah. Or to keep working on Florida. Like, what's their reason for not approving it?
And sometimes they give no reason.
Especially Florida, which I hate to say is the worst. You've got the worst.
We got the worst state.
You got the worst state going there.
You're right.
Yeah. I would say just keep at it. You've got to. Otherwise, what do? You give up? Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay.
Anybody else have a question here at this point?
There.
Also be...
Elaine Broadley, I thank you for all of your advocacy.
Thank you.
It must be frustrating. You said that Americans have access to the Canadian database. Mm-hmm. Very quick question. Do we have access to theirs?
There is a high level of cooperation, but so much of it is state-driven. Like their criminal law is divided between the federal level and the states. And so my answer is I don't know for sure, but I don't think we have the same access to theirs. But I don't know for sure. But there's a high level of cooperation.
Hi, I'm a social worker, just retired out of the field of geriatrics, and was happy to note that people are at least paying some attention to the needs of the elderly in prison and leaving prison. What is overlooked, though, with the aging population as they age with longer sentences, one of the really important compounding factors is dementia, which is very overlooked. So you have a portion of people in prison who are dementing without treatment, without special consideration. When they leave, they literally open the door and say, ciao. These people are found wandering the streets, often picked up by the cops, brought to hospital emergencies, and then they try to come up with some sort of plan. People very isolated, who've lost contact, not only with reality, but any family or any community. Often they don't even know who they are. And I feel it's almost added punitive measures by keeping such people in these states in prisons. Mm-hmm. And what surprised me even more is dementia is often missed in the court system because they're not assessed by people who are sensitive to the criteria and what the presentation looks like. So they are sentencing, and these people are serving time and obviously getting worse and then being released. Ironically, though, some of them respond really well to the rigidity of the day routine in prison. So when they leave, it's actually worse for them. So that can happen too, which is sort of a bit of a, you know, compounded issue as well. So I just wanted to bring this out for both people in the legal system. When you're dealing with somebody and you don't quite seem right, you've got to get a geriatrician to see them. Usual doctors miss them, psychiatrists miss them, OTs miss them. Most social workers miss it too. Can be very subtle and very serious.
Yeah, thank you for that. And one of the myths, of course, inside is that, oh, well, you get to see a psychologist. Yeah, you might see that psychologist for half an hour once a month, okay? That's about the frequency. It's very hard to attract people to work in penitentiaries, whether psychiatrists, social workers, what have you, because a lot of people feel, well, I can have a nice job, you know, in the community, or I can go to work in the penitentiary with people who are snarly and, you know, just it's not as pleasant, or the penitentiary is, you know, Brian Mulroney's penitentiary in Port Carshay, the back of beyond, you know. So it's very hard to attract people.
We have time for two more questions. Jim, back there.
Hi there.
Hi.
Thank you for your talk. Really appreciated it. I'm a duty counsel lawyer, and I'm constantly seeing at the front line many of the people who are arrested for violent crimes have significant mental health issues. Mm-hmm. And it seems that we're missing that component when we're evaluating whether they're eligible for bail or how we sentence them for these crimes. I wonder, can we be doing more to educate the staff of corrections about mental health, about significant mental health issues like schizophrenia, bipolar, psychosis, things that I think we hold these accused to account for their actions, but we do it in a way that doesn't really include that kind of deeper understanding about what's really happening.
Mm-hmm. So, well, you're in the right place at the right time because Justice Cole is currently doing a review of the Ontario remand population in terms of mental health. and what's available and what's not and what could be improved. So you might want to even corner him before you leave. that's the best way. He's from Peterborough, you know. So, yeah, very topical point.
Actually, our first speaker in the series 9 years ago was Judge Armstrong. And he was the one that started a mental health court in Toronto. So I assume we will corner David on this topic after our session today. Yeah. Time for one last question. Any more? We all done? Thank you. Thank you very much for coming. I'm going to ask Jim Black.
Thank you. Thank you.